Welcome to the Flow Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:24 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 29th. I thought we'd kick off today with Gilead because they've had some positive news about the efficacy of remdesivir in treating the coronavirus. And that has helped to support the share now over the course of the last 3 months. But perhaps more important than that is Gilead badly needed a new hit because the share has been underperforming for really quite a considerable period of time. But importantly, it hit a peak back in 2015 with the wider biotechnology sector. It's looking increasingly likely that this is a base formation completion, and it is going to lend some efficacy to the technology they've deployed in order to come up with treatments for things like the coronavirus or Ebola, which of course is what remdesivir was originally created for. But what we're also starting to see is improving sentiment towards biotechnology generally. The sector peaked following a very significant advance all the way through from 2011 to 2015, and it has spent most of the last 5 years doing not much of anything. It's now right in the region of the upper side of its range. So there is the potential here we may get some consolidation, but it's increasingly likely that the practically unlimited sources of additional money that is going to be poured into developing a vaccine for the coronavirus is on the one hand going to support the balance sheets of biotech companies, but on the other it will greatly accelerate the pace with which they can bring new technologies to the commercial phase. And that's usually something that takes anything from years to decades to do, but it could be done within the space of a year because of the willingness to set aside the slow and steady regulatory phases that drug discovery goes through in order to deliver a working solution in the shortest time possible. The one thing that everyone's worried about is that there's going to be an additional surge in new cases in the autumn or winter of this year. That was certainly something that China came out with yesterday, and in fact they have gone further and said that they believe the coronavirus is going to be seasonal in nature. So they are anticipating that there will be mutations and that will require vaccines annually to combat it in much the same way that we need them for the seasonal flu. Well, one thing that is also worth highlighting about China is they have been very eager to do a number of different things. The first is to highlight that they're working hard to combat the virus and that they're opening up the economy. Consumer sentiment is still quite low, but there are machinations going on in the background that are worth paying particular attention to. This is something we see during every crisis, that there are things that governments try to float in under the radar of consumers and investors during a crisis that they would never normally be able to do in normal circumstances. Well, on the one hand, one of those things for China is rounding up democracy protesters in Hong Kong from their homes. When we look at what's going on in terms of the Hang Seng, then it is now coming back towards the psychological 25,000 level. That was an area of resistance between 2010 and about 2016, with one notable exception. Then it was an area of support from about 2018 onwards. So it's an important area where we would need to see the market being able to sustain a move above it, and most particularly above the trend mean, in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. What we have also seen from China is that they are launching a digital currency. Now, Bitcoin was up over $1,000 in here today. It is now well above the 8,000 level. The halving of the reward for solving the The riddle of each block is going to halve in 12 days' time. So that is going to bolster the limited supply argument for Bitcoin, and it is rallying in anticipation of that event. But the bigger point here is that the introduction of digital currencies, regardless of how well formulated they are, how they are going to be backed, what their security protocols are, whether they're going to be anonymous or not, if they are going to exist in parallel with fiat currencies, what they are in fact is more like a ration book. The clear desire of governments everywhere to dispense with cash, to monitor the spending habits of everyone, and to build up the taxing capability of the government to previously unimagined levels is obviously something that is truly attractive to governments everywhere, because most of them are broke. But also, it's being done under the guise of anti-money laundering, anti-terrorism financing, and anti-black markets. Of course, all of those are laudable in certainly in terms of any society, but at the same time, what they are doing is taking control of everyone's ability to spend money as they wish, or to distribute their own treasure for whatever purpose they deem personally fit, provided, of course, it's not outside the realm of what's legal. What is obviously going to become an issue at some stage is there is a massive quantity of debt outstanding. And do governments really have any intention of paying it back or meeting their obligations? More often than not, they simply roll it on, and the quantities of debt continue to increase in size. Well, when we then think about, where are yields right now? They haven't risen to any measurable extent, but I think the bigger point here is that they're risible when it comes to the potential for a yield to be captured in the bond markets these days. And we have central banks the world over controlling both the short and long ends of the curve and engaging in the repo market, the commercial paper market. They are actively engaged in manipulating the actions of the banking sector as well. So we have central banks that are increasingly taking on debt. We had Jay Powell in here today saying this is not the time to be thinking about the federal deficit. Well, one would have to question when is a good time, if not when the deficit is at $4 trillion. Well, obviously, the bet that markets are making is that we're going to have a solution in terms of treatment and vaccines for the coronavirus within this year. And that's why we've got stock markets rallying. But I think what's happening in terms of the provision of parallel currencies in China to begin with, but probably elsewhere in the not too distant future, is that they will be used as a, I think what is likely at least, they'll be used as ration books, so that if the currency that debts are denominated in is debased at an increasingly rapid pace, that the purchasing power of consumers in everyday items will be heavily controlled by the government, and the provision of ration books will be similar to the kinds of activity that we had during communism in the USSR. So that's, I think, potentially what China is preparing for. We're obviously not there yet, but we do know that they have got a mountain of debt in much the same way that there are mountains of debt just about everywhere else as well. And eventually that is going to come to a climax. Quite whether we're there now or not is very much open to question. We don't have negative yields in the USA or Germany, excuse me, we don't have negative yields in the USA or the UK or Australia, but we definitely have them in Germany and much of Europe. At some point, we're going to have the continued provision of liquidity push global yields everywhere, potentially into negative territory, and it's at that point that things become truly ridiculous. At the moment, at least, you have the potential for arbitrage. It's when that arbitrage opportunity is completely excised from the market that I think we'll probably have the denouement in the bond markets, but we're nowhere near that yet. But what we can see is that some of the building blocks for the kind of solutions that will arise when that eventually does occur are now being put in place. Now, when we look at what's going on in the stock market, the S&P 500 has rallied rather impressively again in here today and completely unwound yesterday's weakness. It is now only about 65 points away from the 200-day moving average and 60 points away from the psychological 3000 level. Well, 3000 has been an area of resistance on a number of occasions over the course of the last 2 years. We had a clear break above it in late 2019 and then a very large pullback in the early part of this year and a very swift rebound over the course of the last 7 weeks. This has been very clearly a short covering rally from the perspective of the futures traders, and retail investors have been very eager to buy the dip, and buying the dip has been by far the most successful strategy during the last 10 years. And a buy the dip strategy is the best trading strategy or investment strategy during any secular bull market, because in a secular bull market, significant pullbacks, when they occasionally occur, are always going to be buying opportunities. It's when the buy the dip strategy fails. That's when we have got the clearest evidence that a bull market is in fact over. So far, the buy the dip strategy has not failed. And so far, we have seen a very impressive rally. Now, how much value there is to be gained by buying at today's level when we are only 60 points away from a significant area of potential resistance is very much open to question. And there is, I think, clearly still the potential that we are going to have a process of consolidation evolve here. The first quarter of this year, everything was going fine until the middle of March. It was around the 15th of March, excuse me, I think it was the 12th of March, that sales on Mrs. Tracy's Amazon store collapsed. And they have been bubbling along at 60% below where they were in early March for the last 7 weeks. There is no sign yet of growth starting to come back. So until that point, it had been a year that was up about 12% on last year. And what I find particularly interesting is that it's the growth figures that we had from Google today gel almost exactly with the contraction that Mrs. Tracy's small Amazon business has ex experienced in it's almost like a microcosm of the kind of spending decline that Google is probably going to have in the second quarter. But it did pop on the upside in here today, and it is now back above the psychological $1,300 level. And I think that this is important because $1,300 has been an area of resistance on multiple occasions over the course of the last two and a bit years. And it was the failed upside break above that level. Then it came right back down and tested the $1,000 level. So having rallied 49%, it gave up the entire advance and has now recouped more than half of it. The rivetingly consistent staircase step sequence uptrend with $100 increment advances started to degrade in 2018. Then we had a much bigger pullback. And subsequently a lengthier range. It was and remains absolutely necessary that Google be able to sustain the move above $1,300. If we had to think about where do people have their stops, well, we would have to think that the most obvious place that people have stops on a share like Google is probably below this $1,000 level, because it's been an area of support on 5 separate occasions. So even here we've got the improving outlook that it has now been able to pierce and rally through an important area of resistance, but it absolutely has to hold it. Then what we are also definitely starting to see is some rotation. Investors are willing to bet that some of the worst of the selling pressure has already taken place in the cruise line sector, and also potentially now all within the energy sector. So these are, I think, rather important developments, that there were a significant number of shares that were up in double digits in here today. And if we simply take Royal Dutch Shell, golly, I keep saying that, Royal Caribbean Cruises, I do apologize, then there is obviously now a bid coming through when the share was down in the region of 90%, or at least 85%. Then we've had a doubling over the course of the last month. It has found support at a progressively higher level, and it's hard to imagine that news is going to get worse. In that case, it could potentially get better. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're going all the way back up to 140. We're probably likely to have a great deal of volatility, because they don't know when they're going to be allowed to sail again, and they certainly don't know how eager consumers are going to be to get back on board ships, or that ships will be able to carry the same number of people, or that they will be able to charge the same quantity of money to people for their berth. So these are all significant outstanding questions, and it does rather suggest that any potential for them to go all the way back up to that Type 3 top formation is, I think, rather ambitious, but at least the $20 area is probably the low. And I think this is the kind of bet that people are taking, that some of the very oversold conditions are likely to be unwound. I continue to think that to plot a route through this environment, it is some of the dividend aristocrats are going to become particularly attractive. Now, when we look at, for example, Cisco, where they are one of the biggest providers of food and linens to the hospitality and the restaurant sector, then the share has just about doubled over the course of the last 6 weeks, and it has still only unwound about half of the oversold condition. This has been an incredible shock to the sector, but this is a company that has never cut its dividend, and the yield has now compressed to about 3%. When we go back and think about what the yield was just over about 1 month ago, or maybe a little bit more than that, it was over 5%. And we just do not see yields in the region of 5% for Cisco, not even when we go back towards the period around 2009. So we've had a very meaningful change and a clear rebound from extraordinarily deep oversold conditions for big dividend paying stocks, the kinds of companies that have got the financial heft to ensure that they can continue to pay their dividends, against a background where a large number of companies are completely cutting their dividends. There are a small minority that will continue to increase theirs. And while IBM has been a disappointment for investors for really quite a prolonged period of time, it is looking increasingly likely that they will be inducted into the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats over the course of the next month. And I think that is also helping to support the share. But that also helps to highlight the fact that there are a significant number of companies within the technology sector that have got long histories of paying dividends. In fact, the technology sector is one of the most reliable in terms of increasing dividends of any sector. It rather suggests that within the next 10 to 15 years, the Dividend Aristocrats sector is likely to be dominated by technology companies. When, for example, we look at Cisco Systems' record of increasing its dividend, then it's been going on for years already. And that is despite the fact that the share has been really quite volatile. They have been able to continue to increase their dividend. This is also really quite clear in terms of Microsoft. The yield is not an especially competitive one, but the dividend growth is still in the region of about 10%, and there is nothing to stop Apple from continuing to raise its dividend. And it's already been raising the dividend steadily for 10 years. 15 years from now, it will almost certainly be a Dividend Aristocrat. That's also, I think, one of the important points, that when we look at the technology sector, it is there the impressiveness of their dividend, or their balance sheets and their margins, that have been able to continue to deliver dividend growth and strong performance. Roper Technologies is already a Dividend Aristocrat, and it has also rebounded impressively. Now, I think when we look at what's going on, and there are two different arguments. The one that the market is relying on right now is that the massive provision of liquidity is enough, that it is going to continue to inflate asset prices. And there is good historical precedent for that, because we have been relying on exactly that argument for the last decade. This has been a liquidity-fueled bull market. The other side of it is that it is being delivered with higher multiples, because earnings took a hit in the first quarter. They're going to take a much bigger hit in the second quarter. But the ability of earnings to rebound in the third and fourth quarters is going to be inhibited by social distancing and a reluctance of consumers to engage in the same kinds of social activities that they had previously. All of the potential for a very sustained and impressive economic rebound is going to be dictated by the willingness of governments to continue to supply liquidity, as well as the delivery of treatment mechanisms for the coronavirus. That's one of the most important things that we need to monitor. Eventually, the deficits are going to have to come into play. And one thing that is also worth highlighting is that this is an election year. It is historically, just on a cyclical basis, among the best performers in the US presidential cycle. And the first year of the new cycle is usually the worst, because the excesses of the fourth year, where governments routinely attempt to buy the election, generally tend to get paid for. And politically speaking, it's when an administration has got room in which to make cuts, because they're not seeking election for another 4 years. And especially in the second term, then they turn more towards the legacy of the presidency. One thing that is, I think, an easy prediction is that we're going to have an infrastructure boom. China's already talking about a $600 billion infrastructure boom. The London Metals Index is still really very depressed. Copper prices have rebounded from around the $2.50 area, or $2 area, I should say. They have not been able to push back up into the overhead range just yet, but it is still unwinding the oversold condition. Once we get the lockdowns ending, and I think there are rational arguments for ending lockdowns in places which have not had large numbers of cases. And it is reasonable to anticipate that, having been locked down for a month, that if new cases are not surging higher, then that the pace of infection has moderated. That doesn't mean that we have to jump back into planes right away, but it does mean that local economies can start to wind back up again. Eventually, that is going to translate into a spending program, and infrastructure is on the lips of every politician because it's a vote grabber, it's a jobs provider, and it generally, depending on how it is spent, will create an asset that is income producing or value or productivity producing for years to come. And it's also required because infrastructure everywhere in the developed world is aging and needs to be replaced. Then we think about the oil price. It was up about 10% in here today, but it's looking increasingly likely that $20 is probably the low for Brent crude, and $10 is the, and perhaps it is better to just simply look at the individual contract, the, and I don't know why that didn't work. Brent crude is probably the low around the $10 mark. With the liquidation of the U.S. oil fund position in June contracts, it is now much less likely to go negative, and that removes a major source of supply from the market. So then there is the potential that we can rebound from here. And we are at still only a quarter of the value that oil was trading at the beginning of the year. So there is ample scope here for a rebound. When we look at some of the major producers, then they've also rebounded. They continue to impress here. They have got some of the longest histories of paying and increasing dividends. But the bigger picture from the perspective of the major oil producers is that they have the clear potential to buy up properties out of bankruptcy and consolidate the shale industry in the USA, which would help to reduce the average cost of production. And that's a necessary component if it's going to survive. I think it's inevitable that we're going to get some significant rationalization, but the sector will continue to survive. It's likely to continue to keep a lid on the ability of oil prices to rally significantly. But what's also, I think, particularly important here is that the renewables continue to perform. That's true of both wind and solar. It's also true of the hydrogen sector. So we definitely have a potential here that hydrogen is going to become a more significant factor in the global energy mix. What the clear message here is that renewables can now prosper even in a low fossil fuel energy environment, and that is a big change. This is again another example of a trend that's evolving, which is, I think, very much outside of what the media are reporting. It's completely slipping under the radar in terms of what people are focusing on, but renewable energy, with the potential for a massive infrastructure build, is potentially going to be one of the sectors that performs best coming out of this crisis. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.